If you've driven through DeKalb, you've driven past this place. Chances are you never even noticed it. Or maybe you asked yourself, why is there a barn behind Burger King? Then shrugged and kept hustling toward Northern Illinois University's campus. What you're missing is one of the richest historic sites around and the opportunity to forge a link to our nation's past. Welcome to Under Rocks, I'm Susan Stevens. Tucked behind Glidden Florist on Lincoln Highway, you'll find not just the barn where the winter barbed wire was invented, but the magnificent Joseph F. Glidden Homestead and Historical Center. And behind that beautiful house, a tiny workshop where one of the oldest and most important professions throughout history is still practiced, blacksmithing. Stay with us as the hammer of the gods has passed from Vulcan to DeKalb's most famous blacksmith, Phineas Vaughn, to modern-day blacksmith Martin O'Connor, to Dan Libman of the Under Rocks team.
Okay. Hi there, Spencer.
Spencer, Marty.
Dan.
How are you, Marty?
Hey, Sue!
we had the wrong barn. Thanks for having us out and to talk with us.
I brought my own overalls. I don't know if they need
it. I wasn't sure whether you wanted to kind of start in the house, if you're familiar with any of... Have you visited before? Okay, we'll give you an overview. I'll have my wife just tend the fire. Have any of you visited the house before?
You know, I've never been here.
This is so embarrassing, no.
Hi, okay. I'm Linda. Marjorie's Linda.
Well, this is... The Glidden Homestead, J.F. Glidden, invented or came up with the first practical barbed wire. The house, as you can see by the date there, 1861, so it's an antebellum house. Abraham Lincoln was president when it was built. So here at the homestead, we like to focus on local history. One of their catchphrases is, history happened here. So we don't focus so much on period dress and trying to give people a trip back in time so much as tell them that it happened right here.
Is this the place where he actually invented the barbed wire?
Yes, the barn out right to the there? East here is where he made his first wire.
Wow.
Real quick too, give us your full name and your title here.
I'm Marty O'Connor and I'm the lead blacksmith, docent volunteer. We demonstrate every Sunday from noon to 4, and at the same time we'll do classes. So if somebody wants to join us for that 4 hours for one-on-one, they pay $75 and they get the 4-hour class, hopefully with something they can take home to remember it.
Hands-on blacksmithery? What's the verb of blacksmith?
Smithing, I guess.
Smithing, okay.
Yeah.
Hands-on smithing.
Mm-hmm.
They get to take home a chunk of whatever they...
Yeah, we seem to focus a lot on bottle openers because that's what I have.
What was he reaching for in the gift shop?
I saw that. I didn't realize.
Like, I'm making this.
Such a practical.
I have so much practice with the horse heads that I can kind of get a lot of it done in one heat now. So that's the easiest thing to demonstrate, and it's a lot of work to show a student, and it's advanced for first timer to do. But we manage to get through a lot of them in 4-hour period.
Before we get into the real thing, Marty shows us a demonstration. Sitting on the table is a small anvil, a hammer, and a piece of clay.
Let's get into some blacksmithing. We've got a mini anvil here.
That's a jeweler's anvil. It's actually a good anvil. Most anvils are made of the body is kind of a softer iron. The original ones were just pulling pig iron out of the foundry fire and hammering it, forging it directly into the body of it. And then the top part, the face, is always a hardened steel, and that's usually welded to it. This one may be probably all cast, all in one is cast steel, but originally they were a softer, heavy body, and then this is a hardened work surface, the plates, and you'll see it on the anvils out there too. And this is kind of the basic European shape. All the work is done between the surfaces of the hardened hammer face and the face of the anvil or across the horn. Different surfaces give you different results. You're basically squeezing and forming it just like it was a piece of clay. Only to do it, you've got red hot steel and hard tools.
Yeah. You said pig iron. What is pig iron?
I think it's just a name for sort of the crude smelting, the first iron that comes out of the smelting furnace and stuff.
Okay.
I could have the details wrong on that, but that's good what enough. They refer to it as.
Just pig, okay.
Blacksmithing is all about reshaping, moving metal, where you got your additive processes, taking the pig iron out of the smelting furnace, or getting a large-scale foundry casting big billets of iron or steel. And then in between, so you've got a large piece that's a big square or rectangular section. To turn it into something else, you have to draw it out in length, usually the different bar stock, and then to reshape the bar. It's much more efficient to heat it up and bend it into the shape you want and offset things than it would be to saw away all your waste and machine things. So things like, say, a crankshaft for a small motor. If I needed to make a crankshaft, I might bend this down. It's just cheat with my hands here a little bit, but bend something like that.
I guess you can't really use your hands. No. Is it, when it comes out of the smelter, how much time do you have before it's too cool to bend?
The working time you have with it varies depending on how cold it is in the shop, how cold the anvil or the vise, the tools you're working with. They suck a lot of heat out of it. The anvil is a huge heat sink. But so it varies. We have a tougher time when it's cold and there's less activity. But like I said, taking this single rod and turning it into a crank leaves you with the piece that's ready to be ground and machined in a machine shop. So you've got your additive process, casting billets or the bar stock. Then you've got in between the forging and reshaping that the blacksmith does, and then the removal or the subtractive manufacturing of the machine shop. So rather than them cut all this stuff away, and they've got a piece that's roughly shaped, and then they can do all the grinding and final finishing.
Well, you are a master with clay. I can't wait to see you with the the real stuff.
Obviously, clay makes it very easy, but to do it with steel, we got to watch the colors of the metal. And this is not a very good color chart. I've got better ones. But you can see the temperature based on the color. That's why it's slightly dark in the blacksmith shop, so you can observe the color and know just how soft it is. We want it up to, I like to wear the orange shirt because this is ideal temperature. Right in here, you somewhere below melting point, but you've softened it up quite a bit where it can, you've got longer working
around
time.
2,000 degrees, it looks like.
Yes. Yeah. And then it's at its most dangerous when it's back here looking cold again, but it's not. It's still 1,000 degrees.
Jesus.
So,
amazing.
And welding is at such a bright heat that it's hard to look at without getting
yeah,
you see spots.
You yeah, sure.
So, if you get it up to a bright yellow, white hot heat, you can see it starting to sparkle and liquefy. That's welding temperature.
Okay. So how in the world did you pick this as your hobby or what you do? How'd you get into it?
I started here because when they first formed the museum and converted the mill house into the blacksmith shop, they wanted to form a blacksmithing club and train docents to work here. And Chris Hubbard was instrumental in that, Dr. Chris Hubbard from NIU. He's a retired anatomy professor and a hobby blacksmith. He donated a lot of the tools like the forge and the anvils and the vise, and he helped train the first people. And they started a club, and we had our first meeting here in 2011. And then we started alternately coming here and doing demonstrations and going out for wine and cheese at my friend's blacksmith shop in Sycamore. No longer there, he's retired, but he had an ornamental blacksmith shop, and we would meet, forge for a couple hours, and then have our wine and cheese afterward.
Nice.
So,
but you knew how to do this before you
no.
got into it? You learned? You
no,
just...
I've been doing this since 2011.
Okay. So what was the interest?
I've always been interested in machinery and tools and things. I collect a lot of tools. I worked for 25 years in machine maintenance at the Alloyed Sunoco Company. My family comes from a line of farmers. My dad was a maintenance engineer. And so I always had the hands-on interest in tools and wood carving tools and all sorts of things. So when the opportunity came up to learn blacksmithing, I went ahead and joined them. And it's been a lot of fun, especially when we host the school kids and we see how engaged they get. To them, it's like a magic show, you know, playing with fire and orange steel.
Yeah,
it's fun.
So.
Next, Marty takes us into the gift shop, where we see the horse-shaped bottle openers that Dan Libman will be forging.
Do a lot of bottle openers because they make good souvenirs. Around Halloween, we tend to do the skulls and the
Oh, these are
owls.
Great. I love these.
Horse heads are the most common. I've got the most practice with them, and I can knock them out fairly
quick.
Like
the cat.
The cat takes a bit more work. I haven't finalized or developed the tooling I need to get the face just right. Or the.
I love it, though. Each one's unique, you know?
Yeah,
it's
yeah, even the horses, you can see how the variance.
Yeah.
Wow.
As I started to show you with the clay, seahorses are...
Oh,
we
okay.
do a lot of them because it shows you four of the basic techniques from setting down on a near edge, far edge, drawing, tapering, and scrolling all in one piece. So it's, and it's with the small ones, it's something I can do quickly during a demo while people are visiting. They hate to just see you pound on a piece and nothing happens to it. So working on small stuff that you can complete the process is helpful. You'll see more.
Okay.
You'll be sick of horses. So,
oh, this is cool.
The nastiness of the coal.
Okay, tell us what you're doing here.
Okay.
So you're clearing out an area.
Yeah, cleared out what was no longer burning. Somehow my lovely assistant didn't maintain. But so this grate at the bottom opens up to, they have what's called a clinker breaker in there. It's just a little knob that kind of shakes things down off the bottom. Air to come up through.
Getting
the
soot out there. And then this thing you're cranking is pumping the air in.
This hand crank style blower. Probably invented in the mid-19th century to replace the earlier versions, which would have been like a leather bellows. You've seen mills all the time. Sometimes had large ones overhead, and they would pull a handle. We usually get a small wood fire going, and then we push the coal in around it because it's a little harder to start. We use both coke and coal. Coal is, like up here, you see the... bituminous coal, and it's kind of shiny and very dirty, harder material. And then this is the coke. You can see the porosity, and it's lighter, more porous and dull. That's basically coal that has had all the sulfur and the metals and other impurities cooked out of it, and it's almost pure carbon. So it's what charcoal is to wood after you've baked it off in a low oxygen environment, you end up with pure carbon. So this, if there's anything you could call clean coal, it's coke.
Okay.
So if we get a nice wood fire going, glowing embers, and then push the coke up next to it, it'll burn fairly cleanly. If we just try to start one right away with the pure coal,
yeah,
it'll definitely burn a lot dirtier.
I'm guessing you've gotten burned.
Yes, frequently.
You probably have a resistance built up a little bit.
Like I said before, the most dangerous part is the steel that you forget is hot. It's starting to cool down, it's sitting there, or you impulsively reach down and pick something up that was dropped. That's a habit you break pretty quickly. But not knowing that it's hot because it's black, that'll fool you, and you get burnt a lot of times that way.
So when you're doing class, do you take them from making the fire to finished product?
Most of the time we don't.
Okay.
If they happen to show up early, they get the whole experience.
Uh-huh.
Or if it's people that are looking to start their own setup at home.
Is blacksmithing a one-person job?
Definitely not. It can be. You can do a lot of. I can do lots of small stuff like these bottle openers alone. And of course, once the material gets too hot to hold with your hand, I like to start with large pieces, especially for beginners, so that it takes a long time before they can't handle it with their hands anymore. Once you have smaller pieces or the work is hot all its full length, then you've got to switch to tongs. So you're doing all your manipulating with tongs, and they have different shaped jaws for different types of material. These are all one hand, so I can take my non-dominant hand and use the tongs while I hammer with the other. If I'm working on larger stuff, if I had a piece as big as that brick in there, and then have to go to larger tongs, you see the two-handed ones up there.
Oh, yeah.
So then the smith definitely has to have helpers. He would be manipulating the work with two hands on the anvil, and then strikers would hit it with larger sledges and stuff. That way they can get a lot more efficient work on a large piece. There's no way he can manipulate it by himself.
But it really is just like a pencil with an eraser, because you could just go back in and reheat it if you don't like the angle of something, or if you, right?
Or somewhat. Depends on the operation you're doing. It's really hard to get the genie back in the bottle if you've drawn something out too thin. A good example is doing these bottle opener rings. If we get too thin on it, we can't thicken that
okay.
place there.
And then the bottle doesn't get open. It's yeah. very sad.
Yes. So you can work from thick to thin. It's hard to make something
okay.
thicker from thin. There is a process called upsetting where
the name says it all.
It is, isn't it?
If I have a piece of round stock, this is a good example here, and I wanted this end to be swollen and mushroomed out much bigger, then you keep heating it and you bang it on the anvil or hit it with your hammer while it's in the vise to sort of compress it.
Uh-huh.
So you can add thickness by upsetting, but it's difficult and it doesn't work on delicate things like the bottle opener rings. So let's go ahead and get both irons in the fire.
Oh!
Stick them in the middle.
That's the expression.
Yes. Say, too many irons in the fire means you can't keep up with the work, because one of them's burning up or melting while you're working the other. Or
okay.
Having a few irons in the fire is helpful, because you can switch while you're working one and it's cooling down, the other one's in the fire ready to go. And you can go back and forth.
You want a couple.
Work pieces.
I got a couple of irons in the fire.
I think like horseshoes, when I think of blacksmiths, every town had to have at least one. This was yeah. probably the biggest job that disappeared.
It was definitely highly respected profession from the very beginning. They were considered gods in Greece. They had Hephaestus and Vulcan, the Roman version.
Yeah.
They were parts of every boat or party of immigrants coming over from Europe. They would want a blacksmith aboard the ship, both for things that needed to be fixed and made on the ship, as well as when they come to colonize, they'd want somebody in that community as a blacksmith. There's in the English Blacksmiths Guild, they have saying, their motto is, by hammer and hand all arts do stand, because it was a blacksmith who made the tools for every other profession, just about, from surgery, surgeon's tools, seamstress tools, cooking, wood carving, forestry, everything. It was always the blacksmith made all the hardened tools. So. Okay, now we can see. I'll give you a little demonstration. This is what the kids love.
I can already.
Gotta be.
I can see why. Did you see how hot it was? It's bright orange.
I grabbed my chart.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, you can see here. This is as orange as my shirt. This is over 1700 degrees. But if I'm out here in the sun.
Oh, whoa.
It's black.
Jeez.
So that's why the darkness, the dinginess of the blacksmith shop helps to give you an idea of how warm the steel is. And then they say, you know, the reason we have a sand floor in the shop is if we didn't,
holy cow,
we dropped pieces on the floor.
Marty presses the glowing steel into a small piece of wood, which immediately bursts into flames. It's a pretty great demonstration.
So we're going for a bright orange. That'll give us the most working time. And then as soon as it makes contact with the anvil, you're sucking heat out of it with the anvil and stuff. So
right.
You've got to be ready to strike when you pull it. They say strike while the iron's hot. So many of these colloquialisms and stuff came from, if they weren't from nautical terms, they were from blacksmithing, it seems like. We don't ever hit the hardened face of the hammer directly on the anvil. We try to avoid hard impacts because this could chip and go flying, hurt somebody, damage our tools. Same thing with the anvil.
So do you practice things on clay? Is that how you develop something that you
sometimes,
want?
Yes. Okay. It works out real well for knowing the volume of material you want to start with. That's the thing about, as I said, it was reshaping material rather than removing or creating material. So the volume you start with is the volume you end up with, unless you trim something off. So,
what's the big bucket of water for?
That's to cool and quench things.
Okay.
Mostly
like if your
we'll
pants
use it
catch
when
on fire,
the,
you've
the
seen
the
it.
Punch. But if we were trying to quench something for hardening and tempering, we'd need the water.
Put it in the water. Okay.
Some things are quenched in oil as well.
Really?
But there's always a water tub nearby for situations where you have to cool something off quick.
Okay.
Is this your anvil?
No. Actually, I mentioned Dr. Chris Hubbard that started this.
Yeah.
He donated these. Okay. The larger one there came from the Chicago Stockyards. And you kind of test an anvil if you're buying one or something. With the rebound test, to take a solid steel ball, and if I drop it here, I get 40-50% return, roughly. If I do it on this anvil, it's much better. I get almost 80 or 90% return. So this is actually a higher quality, more responsive anvil than the big
one. And it's because of this top plate.
Well, they both have the top plate, but for some reason, this one has a little more deadness in the density of it. Is not as responsive as this.
So, but I wonder what the difference
it's
is.
Kind of like how tightly strung a racket or something might be. You know, this one's going to have much faster return.
And you want that for obviously, but.
Because most of the time, whatever you're doing to the top of the workpiece, the anvil is doing an equal and opposite reaction on the bottom.
Okay.
So if the anvil's kind of somehow spongy or dead or loose, then you don't get what you want. The hammer's going to be doing all the work in the anvil.
So this just maybe has to do with age, the fact that this is older and been used more, that it lost some of that spring?
Could be maybe not as good a quality steel plate.
Uh-huh.
That might be it. I see there's a lot more little dents and dings in it, so it might be softer than this one.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Dan is making progress on his horse head bottle opener. Let's see how he's doing so far.
Right now, yours is probably a little wider up here.
Oh, lame.
Kind of like that.
So I need to come down.
So you put it in the same place, but make sure that don't hit back here. Hit up here with a little more hammer angle.
That's okay, he's got a big eye.
Okay.
You hate when you hear him go, oh, whoop. When I do something and he goes, whoop, it's not a good sign.
But then he takes it to the fire eraser and it's okay.
I hit it really hard, I know it doesn't look like it, and then when you take the thing out, it's just a little dimple, there's nothing to it.
Yeah, we weren't very hot there. I'm going to try to get it a little hotter this time and go faster.
We'll blame the heat.
Don't be afraid of it, hit it hard, keep it on the anvil. Right there.
Dan, how'd it feel?
It's hard. It's difficult. It's like hitting steel. It's like not. It's not soft like the clay at all. It's really hard.
Yeah.
So I mean, it takes a lot of heat just to get a little bit of give on the strike.
Maybe you could try this one. It might be a little easier to handle with a slightly shorter.
Okay.
So you're pretty much the shape you want. Maybe a couple more times here, and then flatten again to keep this. See, we're slightly wider on the top of his head.
Yeah.
If we have to have a second hit, you got to put it back down there and register in the same place.
Okay.
And hit it the same way. Right. If you start hitting two or three times thinking you didn't get it, you'll usually get two or three little steps here, and it'll make it all wrong.
Your one horse of those terrible.
Guernica horses. That, yes. You know. Look, when you see my finished horse, do not blame yourself. You're doing everything you can. Hold on, you're doing everything right.
What's the flying off here when he's hitting it? This black stuff that you're blowing off.
The scale, the iron oxide scale that comes off.
It's not
and
hot.
It also ends up back in the forge, and it kind of recongeals in the heat, and you get hard steel-like clinkers in the bottom that plug things up. The more delicate the piece gets, like the ring of this, when we get down to this stage and it's real thin, we got to really watch it. That part can sparkle away in seconds.
Oh.
So that's why it's really hard to get this final detail in the little thumbnail, because we've got to get it heated up here rather than here where it's delicate. So we push that all the way through to the cold part of the fire, and we try to heat it in here and then bring it out and do it.
Dan pounds in the final part of his bottle opener, and Marty finishes the piece by filing down the edges, rounding them off, and then coating the metal in beeswax.
Now that's got to hang and cool for a little bit.
So how do you think Dan did on his first bottle opener here, Marty?
Very well. He's got a functional bottle opener. That's the key thing. It looks good
for me. It looks fantastic there.
Look at that.
It really does. Wow. I mean, the color really changed. I mean, that's the beeswax that changed the color?
Yeah, the beeswax kind of blackens it a little bit. And we use this old rag that's half impregnated with beeswax to buff it out usually once it cools enough to touch.
Now, what will I have to do to maintain that? How often will I have to take it to a blacksmith and get it reshaped?
Should last a long time. Shouldn't be a problem. I haven't had the beeswax finish. I haven't had any issues with it rusting or wearing away. It seems like it just sits in a kitchen drawer all the time, and I've been using one for 5 years. It works fine.
Wow. And we should mention that, you know, people can buy themselves one of these too. But if they want to come see how they're made, Marty, how can people learn more about how to take classes here or to sign up for a class with you?
Call the Glidden Homestead at 815-756-7904 or email Jesse at GliddenHomestead.org.
There you go.
More info on the class.
Fantastic. And you do this once a week?
Yes.
And I have to say, it's weirdly, like, it's very centrally located. I go past here on walks all the time. Like, you know, I walk from Revis to Starbucks. I walk past this. I never knew it was here. Yep. I knew the florist was here. But, I mean, people should stop by. You've got a well-stocked gift shop of bottle openers of various stripes, postcards, and educational material.
So is there any advice you would give or things you'd say to someone who's interested in getting started with this?
Well, to be able to try it out with someone else's tools and space is handy. So they can if you've already got your own or you insist on starting up and being self-taught, there's plenty of YouTube channels. There's some really good books out there. And you can join Facebook groups that share a lot of blacksmithing ideas and work. So there's plenty of ways to pick it up.
But if you don't happen to have a 300-pound anvil, you can come here and use yours.
Nice. These are the hands of a day's work.
Yeah. And now we can open our beers again.
This was so nice of you to show us all this.
Thank you so much. This was a lot of fun.
I really like sharing it. Learned a lot. People can accomplish something they can save as a souvenir.
Any final things you guys think we need to know or hear about the homestead?
Welcome people to come to the homestead and learn about local history. There's a lot of significance in this site, very historic and very influential in American history. The industry that grew out of this eventually became United States Steel.
Thanks to our blacksmith, Marty O'Connor, and firekeeper, Linda O'Connor. Also, thanks to Jesse Hayes-LaRue, executive director of the Glidden Homestead, for suggesting this show. You can get your own horsehead bottle opener the fun way by taking a blacksmithing class at the Glidden Homestead in DeKalb. They are offered every Sunday. Not only do you end up with a practical knowledge about blacksmithing, but you end up with this beautiful, beautiful bottle opener. And does it work? Hold on. Oh yeah. Nothing tastes as good as that first sip from the bottle you opened with your own bottle opener forged from your hard labor. If you've got an idea for Under Rocks that will set us to forging a new episode, send it to us at rocks@niu.edu. Under Rocks is produced at WNIJ at Northern Illinois University by me, Sue Stevens, and Spencer Tritt, although the two of them do much more work than I do. Thanks for listening.